Hey, yo, go, 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 while listening to Doin' Cast.
Walt sent me.
Anybody understand what this duck is saying? Most amusing. I've worked with a lot of wise quackers, but you are despicable.
Done, done, scallywagger. I did it.
This is the last time I work with someone with a speech impediment. This means war.
What, you think that's funny?
Oh, it's a panic.
You won't think it's funny when I stick that pen up your nose.
Now calm down, son, will you? Look, the stain's gone. It's disappearing ink.
No hard feelings, I hope.
Look, I know who you are. Marvin Acme, the guy that owns Toontown, the Gag King.
If it's Acme, it's a gasser. Put it there, pal. The hand buzzer.
Still our biggest seller.
Scotch on the rocks. And I mean ice.
Those ducks are funny. They never get to finish the act.
Hello and welcome to, well, alright. I am TFG and Mike. I am the host of Tooncast and MWire, and this will be the first of one out of two of the Tooncast MWire crossovers. Today we are going to be discussing Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and I am joined by fellow podcaster and world-renowned author of the Caffeine Collection, Steve Snowball Sailor of This Week in Geek. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, hello. I say hello three times because it's just as epic to be on this show.
Yes, actually you'll be on two shows. It'll be one record, but it's going to be on both the MWire feed and the Tooncast feed.
Sweet. Slowly taking over the world.
Yes, yes, yes. So the reason why we are doing this episode, actually it's two different number episodes. For Tooncast, it's episode 24. For MWire, it's episode 18.5. So depending on which feed you're listening to, the episode numbers will be different. The reason why we're crossing it over for both feeds is because Roger Rabbit, or Who Framed Roger Rabbit, is a live-action/animation film because they combined both live-action and traditional animation in the film. And I would like to point out, before we get too far into the material, that this was not the first. A lot of people think that Roger Rabbit was the first ever live-action meets animation. It was not. There were several of them done in the golden age of animation back in the 30s with Looney Tunes. The most popular one I can remember is You Oughta Be in Pictures, is where Daffy convinces Porky that he needs to go to mainstream movie and get out of animation. And they actually show Leon Schlesinger talking with Porky. Another one I can think of is when Jerry Mouse of Tom and Jerry dances with Gene Kelly. But a lot of people seem to think, and I was one of them, a lot of people seem to think that Roger Rabbit was the first ever live-action and animation film put together, but apparently it wasn't.
I think with this movie, it's more of the fact that it was the first like kind of full-length feature film.
Right.
That kind of sort of incorporated this like live action with animation. I mean, yes, obviously it's not the absolute first, but I think it's kind of the one that really was made into like that, because making animation and making live action film is like literally doubles the work. So the fact that they were able to do this at that time, that's just incredible in of itself.
Yes, yes. So how are you, Steve?
I am doing awesome. I am busy, I'm tired, and yet but it's a good busy and tired, know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Steve just released on the 28th of October your second or third book?
It is my second book.
Second audio book. It's The Caffeine Collection, which is a dynamic podcast. Now, what the hell are you guys calling it now? I don't know.
It's a dynamic audiobook.
Ah, there we go. You had mentioned on Twitter a couple of times about a contest, and I don't think I ever saw the results of that. Has that been tallied, or?
Well, actually, you know, I was gonna save this for the actual.
If you don't want to reveal it, that's fine. You don't have.
No. This is good. This is good. Okay, I was, because obviously I had missed a week in regards to putting out a podcast, just because there was a lot going on as far as the school, because I'm in school for radio broadcasting. There was a major assignment literally due the next day after the podcast was supposed to come out.
Yeah.
So I had to work on that. But there was a particular contest where I asked people to leave reviews on iTunes reviews for the podcast, The Caffeine Collection. And also showing the fact that you subscribe to it, and you, Mike, definitely entered into that, and yes. I can actually reveal right now that you are the winner, sir.
Yay!
So that's a first. I haven't even said that out to anybody yet. So yes, you are definitely the winner of that. So I'll make sure I get you at least a subscription to that audiobook, dynamic audiobook, but before the end of tonight.
Oh, okay, cool, good deal. No, and we need to let people know that the contest was not rigged. Steve and I are, even though we are friends, and This Week in Geek and Geekcast Radio have collaborated on several different episodes. Actually, I have never been on a This Week in Geek topic episode, but whatever, that's beside the point. You know, when I entered this, it was something that he posted on Twitter. Like he said, you know, I entered it just as everybody else. It isn't like, you know, I actually work with Steve on it or anything like that, so.
No, it was definitely not rigged in any way, shape, or form. It just so happened. Literally, it did this all completely random, and yours was the name that came up.
Cool.
There you go.
So we are going to get into the topic, and you're going to hear some Roger Rabbit audio. Actually, we may actually do another little general chat thing before we actually get into the topic, just talking to you about your book and your experience and all that stuff really quick. It'd be, you know, five or 10 minutes, I guess, because I have two different audio portions that I want to put in here, so I need to be able to break them up. So we will be right back.
Roger.
The judge.
The joke don't fit there on your brain. Woohoo! Nice shirt. Who's your teller? Quasimodo? Woohoo! My buddy Betty B. A sour puppy will be. But when I'm done, he'll leave no gun to the joker. He will be C. D. C. H. I love to raise the pain. Believe me, I'm no strain. I feel so great to contemplate and look at me. No pain. No pain. No pain. No pain. No pain.
Merry-go-round broke down. Quite a loony selection for a group of drunken reprobates.
here.
Okay, we are back, and as we said in the first part of this episode, I am joined by Steve Snowball Sailor. One of the reasons why I wanted Snowball on this episode was because he had mentioned, it was a couple of months ago, you had happened to be watching Roger Rabbit, and I had just happened to remember, oh crap, we have a Roger Rabbit review coming up in November. So I was like, oh yeah, so yeah, I can probably get Steve on for that. So yeah, that's the main reason why you're here. In this portion, why don't you tell us, and I mean, I know you've said this a couple of times, why don't you tell us how the Caffeine Collection came to be?
Well, my first podcast novel that I put out called Black Shadow was at the beginning of December 2007. So it literally had been about 2 years almost that I hadn't produced out any new audio stuff or any audiobook content. And I've been wanting to I had a couple ideas going and some that I did announce that didn't exactly work out the way I planned it to. And so during the summer of this year, 2009, I was basically home from school. I was back home, kind of living with the family, and just kind of trying to figure out exactly what I wanted to do, sort of audiobook wise or book wise. And I was writing a bunch of short stories that I just kind of thought, you know, I wanted to try to get myself back into it, into writing a full length novel again. And one of the interviews that I did with for This Week in Geek over the summer was with a musician slash entrepreneur named Jeff Smith. And Jeff Smith is the co-founder of a company called RingtoneFeeder.com. And RingtoneFeeder is specifically for the iPhone, and he actually creates original brand new ringtones that you can subscribe to, and you get two brand new ringtones every single week, and you get it as a paid subscription. So you pay either $2 a month or $20 a year to get these ringtones, and they're all created by him. He's not repurposing any content or kind of taking songs and just re-recording them or whatever. It's just all original stuff that he makes. And then he also released something called a dynamic album. Since he's a musician, he wanted to kind of put out his music using the same format. So he did that, where you pay $15, you get access to all the songs, but then over the course of a year, because it's a podcast subscription, you get all kinds of bonus content. So the reason why it's called Dynamic Album is that the album will grow as time goes by. Mm-hmm. And so him and I started talking about creative stuff, and he was looking for some creative artists to kind of partner up with. And so I kind of suggested to him, well, what about, say, something like stories or like short stories or full length novels? And he was really keen on that idea, kind of right off the hop. And so I started talking to him and his business partner Klaus Lovgren, and so over the course of the next like 2 weeks after that, and him and I sort of. The three of us sort of kind of got this idea going, and we decided, you know what, let's put out a short story collection. And so over the course of summer, I wrote just a bunch of short stories, hopped up on Caffeine because I all wrote them at Starbucks, and just a wide variety of genres, everything from sci-fi to fantasy to comedy to action, pretty much a wide variety of genres that people can have interest in. And I decided to put it all together into one short story collection, and that's what the Caffeine Collection came to be.
Yes, I kind of figured the reason why it was titled The Caffeine Collection is because you're always hopped up on caffeine at Starbucks.
Oh, that's...
Every time that I talk to you, either on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, you know, whatever social medium you want to use, you were always at Starbucks.
That's the thing about the local Starbucks that I was at. I mean, it's sort of every single Starbucks is sort of the same way. Like I can go to any Starbucks now and sort of I can kind of get in that sort of environment. Mm-hmm. But there's something specific about the one that I live near in the Niagara area that it was just kind of. It was very welcoming. It had obviously the same Starbucks thing. There was nothing really specifically different mm-hmm. about that Starbucks, other than the fact that it was close and that there was a lot of regulars there that I knew. I sort of start to get to talk to and kind of. It was just a really open atmosphere that I just loved, and it kind of basically made me more creative as time went on. And then my best friend Shane and I, we would go there constantly to write, and he was kind of like my writing partner in crime, so to speak. And him and I would just go there like constantly, as many times as we can get, and we would just write, and it was so much fun. And that's kind of why I love Starbucks that much. And I like, I have, even in Toronto, where I'm at right now, there is sort of one that I sort of am gravitating towards, but there's always that one that's in the Niagara area that I just love the most.
Right. Yeah. I'm not really that much of a big coffee drinker, and Starbucks is severely overpriced. So yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I'm not really, you would not believe, but I'm actually not a regular coffee drinker in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of those, I would have to have coffee every single day in order to survive. My parents are, but I'm not. And so, but the thing is, I love going there because it's sort of like a specialty thing for me.
Yeah.
If I go to get like a Tazo chai latte or a peppermint mocha frappuccino, whatever it is that I'm going there to get, it's kind of one of those things. It's like, you know what? I feel like I need to kind of have something special, not just a regular coffee. And I like that kind of stuff. And yeah, it's a little bit expensive, but it was worth it in the end.
Well, that's cool. That's cool. And we will, when we do the outro, we will tell everybody where they can get the Caffeine Collection and all that. Up next, you are going to hear what is probably the, I don't know if it's really controversial, but probably the scene from Roger Rabbit where all of the guys turn into howling wolves, and that is the Jessica Rabbit singing scene in the Ink and Paint Club. We will be right back.
Too much.
Cigarettes? Eddie Valiant!
Eddie?
Long time no see!
What are you doing here?
Work's been kind of slow since cartoons went to color. But I still got it, Eddie! Boop, boop, be doop, boop!
Yeah, you still got it. What's with him?
Mr. Acme never misses a night when Jessica performs.
Got a thing for rabbits, huh?
You had plenty of money, 1922. Some other man do. Get out of here.
She's married to Roger Rabbit.
Yeah. What a lucky girl.
Now if you had prepared 20 years ago, you wouldn't be wandering now from door to door. Why don't you do right like some other man do? Get out.
Okay, and it is time to talk about the wouldn't really say it's, I don't know if it's world famous, but this movie was always one of the most famous movies. Set aside the fact that you have Steven Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis attached to it, but Who Framed Roger Rabbit is a 1988 fantasy comedy film directed by, as I said, Zemeckis, and produced by Steven Spielberg, based on Gary K. Wolf's novel Who Censored Roger Rabbit. Ooh, I wonder if I can find that. I'd like to read that, actually.
Me too.
Yeah. The film combines the use of traditional animation and live action with elements of film noir. It stars Bob Hoskins, Charles Fleischer, Christopher Lloyd, Kathleen Turner, and Joanna Cassidy. Who Framed Roger Rabbit is set in 1947 Hollywood, where cartoon characters referred to as toons commonly interact with the studio system of classic Hollywood cinema. The film tells the story of private investigator Eddie Valiant caught in a mystery that involves Roger Rabbit, an A-list toon who is framed for murder. When did you first see this?
Oh, it has to be definitely when I was a kid. I remember watching it, and I could never really figure out who Roger Rabbit was at the time when I was a kid, but all I remember of Roger Rabbit was watching the little mini cartoon that they had at the beginning of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Yeah.
That was probably the first time I ever saw anything of Roger Rabbit at that point. And then I remember seeing the movie afterwards. I was like, oh, it's just like one from Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And I really sort of enjoyed it. So I never really kind of got into, I guess, the Roger Rabbit sort of... even to this day, I still have no idea whether he had stuff before, like there was an actual series of Roger Rabbit, or he was specifically made for this film.
I think, now I would have to go back and watch the special features on the DVD, but I believe he was specially made for the film. I believe that they made Warner Brothers like cartoons, like with like the cartoon that precedes the movie, Tummy Trouble. Or not Tummy, was it Tummy Trouble? Not Tummy Trouble. But you know what I mean, the one where where Baby Herman's going after the cookie.
Yes, exactly.
I forget what it's called at the present time. You know, I'm sure people are screaming at their iPods saying, it's this, it's this, it's this. That is set up like Warner Brothers and classic Disney cartoons as far as the intro, outro. And actually on the DVD there are, I believe it's every one that they made at the time. And they're all on here. Looking at the back here, doesn't say... but I know that they're all on here. The Tummy Trouble one, where he has to go to the hospital, where Jessica is dressed up as a nurse. There's one where they go to some park. You know, there's like three or four of them on there.
Yeah.
But I don't think, he wasn't mainstream. Obviously, this film was made after the golden age of animation, and I know traditional animation style was starting to come back in the 80s, obviously with them rerunning Looney Tunes on TV and, showing it more in syndication. But I don't think he was ever a main part. It was a fictional part of Maroon Cartoon Studios and stuff, so I don't think it was ever a main thing. I was 8 years old when this film came out.
I
don't remember exactly... I might have seen it, like, maybe a year or two after it came out, like, 89 or 90, but I know I never went to the theater and saw it. I know I never did that. I would have loved to have seen it in theaters. As far as some more information before we actually get into the plot, Walt Disney Pictures purchased the film rights to Who Censored Roger Rabbit in 1981. Jeffrey Price and Peter S. Seaman wrote two drafts of a script before Disney brought Spielberg and Amblin Entertainment to help finance the film. Zemeckis was hired to direct the live-action scenes, with Richard Williams overseeing animation sequences. For inspiration, Price and Seaman studied the work of Walt Disney and Warner Brothers cartoons from the golden age of American animation, especially Tex Avery and Bob Clampett cartoons. Production was moved from Los Angeles to Elstree Studios in England to accommodate Williams and his group of animators. During filming, the production budget began to rapidly expand and the shooting schedule lapsed longer than expected. However, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was released with a financial success and critical acclaim. The film brought re-emerging interest from the golden age of American animation and became the forefront for modern era. Especially Disney Renaissance, Roger Rabbit left behind an impact that included a media franchise and the unproduced prequel Who Discovered Roger Rabbit. This is, I think what might turn people off to this film is the film noir parts of it. I mean, I like that stuff when it's done well. It's not a genre I always like to watch. But that may turn people off. Technically, it is a period piece with animation in it, because obviously, as I've said before, it takes place in Hollywood in 1947. Mm-hmm. I think it still stands well today. I don't think, there are probably, obviously, because it is a period piece, a lot of it is actually dated. You know how we say, the biggest thing that could date a show today is making a Johnny Cochran or O.J. Simpson reference. Well, all of the stuff that's in this film is from 1947, so technically the entire film is dated, but it's done so well as far as going back, especially being made in the 80s and doing a film about the 40s.
Right. It's considered what now a lot of people would call a period piece.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I don't really actually have one paragraph plot synopsis. I wish I did. I mainly just get, as everybody knows, I just get the information from Wiki. If you want, we can go through what plot synopsis I have here. Let's see. 1947 Los Angeles, California. Toons commonly interact with Hollywood studio system and live action and live in a section of the city known as Toontown. I always wanted to go to Toontown. That was so cool.
Me too.
I want to live in Toontown. I want to live on Gingerbread Lane.
Yeah.
Gingerbread Lane's that way. No, it's this way. Roger Rabbit is the star of Maroon Cartoon Animated Short Subjects, but he has trouble following the director's commands, delaying the production. Rumors are spreading that Roger's wife Jessica has a sugar daddy, and studio head R.K. Maroon hires private investigator Eddie Valiant to look into the matter. Eddie, whose brother Teddy was killed by a toon 5 years before, reluctantly takes the job. He discovers that the buxom Jessica is quote-unquote cheating on Roger by literally playing patty cake with Marvin Acme, owner of the Acme Corporation in Toontown. Eddie reveals photographic evidence to Roger, who sinks into depression. Marvin Acme is found murdered the next day. Roger becomes the prime suspect. Okay, how did you... When you first saw this film... I guess as an adult, I guess we could say, how did you like the whole opening going from the cartoon, and then they I don't even think they made a cut. They basically just faded out from the cartoon set into the live action.
Well, you can kind of tell a little bit of a slight difference in the coloring when it switches over from the basically from the cartoon to live action, so you can kind of see obviously that when they made the edited switch over. I mean, that's just me personally. I sort of can look into that. But that whole opening, I mean, that in of itself kind of sort of in a really good way sets up kind of what Roger Rabbit really was and what like why he kind of was known as kind of like think of it this way: in 1947 in Toontown, Roger Rabbit would have been considered the Chaplin of all cartoon shorts.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. He has a lot like, and you can sort of tell that in that opening cartoon, especially with the baby who, or basically, I think it says later on, I think he has like the mind of a 50-year-old, but with the thinking of a 3-year-old. So it's kind of funny that it's just the way the two kind of interact. And I, when I was watching it again, actually, like literally a few days ago, just kind of get myself back into it again, I really did notice that the movie sort of made Roger Rabbit, I guess, the Chaplin, whereas I'd say Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse, in a way, even though they came obviously way before Roger Rabbit did, but in the movie they made it seem like they were all inspired by Roger Rabbit.
Right.
They came out of the woodworks of Toontown to be kind of become famous on their own right. But if they ever were asked in an interview or interviews or whatever, who was your inspiration, they probably would say Roger Rabbit.
Mm-hmm. And as they so after Roger is becomes the prime suspect, we see a scene showing him in Eddie is sent to the Ink and Paint Club, which is a strictly tune review, but it's a human-only crowd. And we open with this giant bouncer. the password to get into the Ink and Paint Club is Walt sent me.
Which I love that line.
Everybody knows that that's a... Well, most everyone knows or should know that that is a play on Mr. Disney himself, Walt Disney.
Yep.
Nice monkey suit. Wise ass.
Yep.
And then it opens up to this just hopping club with all these humans, and these tunes are, you know, the waiters, the waitresses. You got an octopus at the bar. And you got Donald and Daffy on stage. Mm-hmm. This is the very first time and the only time that this has ever happened.
Yeah.
And I'll mention the other one as well later on. This is the only time we have ever seen Donald Duck and Daffy Duck on screen together interacting.
Mm-hmm.
And wow.
I know.
Just wow.
See, and what I love about that particular piece is that I always wondered how they were able to kind of get the rights to get not only basically Looney Tunes interacting with Disney characters. I'm like, that in and of itself was like, that must have been a headache just to try to be able to get the rights to that. But I remember watching it and finding out a little bit later on is when I did some research on it that the people who did the guys who did the voice of Donald Duck and Daffy Duck, they were the original voices.
Yeah, Mel Blanc, and I forget who does Donald. Mel Blanc does Daffy, but...
Yeah, and that's... I kind of figured that Mel Blanc would have done it, but by this time in the 80s, he was close to 80 years old, so...
Yeah, I believe... I cannot be for certain. I believe this was one of the... I'm just going to say it was one of the last things that he ever did.
I honestly think this probably was the last thing he did for Looney Tunes.
Yeah,
like any of his original
characters.
Characters, yes, exactly. Yep.
Now it does say up here where I read earlier, Walt Disney Pictures purchased the film rights, so that would give you, say, you know, if Disney owns the film rights to something, I'm sure they can put their characters into anything and everything. Just like now that they own Marvel, they can, you know, make Mickey Wolverine Mouse or something. I don't know. I mean, I'm just, you know, I mean, but you see what I'm saying, though, right?
Oh, yeah,
because
totally.
Because Disney
totally
owned the film rights to this, they could have, you know, maybe it was a big Disney Warner Brothers collaboration. I don't know.
I could see that. I could see that.
And I do, one of my funniest, one of those scenes, when I was a kid, I would always just laugh myself silly. When they get to the Acme factory, this is the clip that I got.
He says, I haven't been this close to Toontown for a while.
Ow! My biscuits are burning! Fire in the hatch! Oh, he green hornet toes! That's smarts!
Every time that I would see that scene, Yosemite Sam coming shooting out of Toontown, I would just lose my marbles.
That's also Mel Blanc,
yes,
as well. That was,
yes,
one of his characters.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Just every single time. So they're at the crime scene. Before this, it shows why Eddie is a drunk. They actually have a scene in the bar, and we meet Dolores. And the crew that hangs out at the bar, and this jackass Angelo, and come to find out Eddie's brother was killed by a toon. And then it goes into this whole montage of all the old photos, and then Lieutenant Santino cracks an empty bottle into the trash can, waking Eddie up, saying that Marvin Acme's been killed. So at the Acme factory, Eddie is met by Judge Doom of the Toontown District Superior Court and his Toon Patrol Weasel henchman. Now, I gotta say, this is a very weird role for Christopher Lloyd to take. I didn't even know it was Christopher Lloyd at first. when I first...
Oh, I definitely knew, because I remember watching this kind of around the same time I started watching the Back to the Future, and I just knew they both were exactly the same.
Yes, yes, exactly. But I was like, oh, what? No way. What's Doc Brown doing in a movie and being bald? Which, not that Doc Brown isn't bald already, but, you know, he did have some white hair.
Yeah, that's true.
Doom is eager to use the quote-unquote dip, a mixture of chemicals that can dissolve any cartoon character on contact. He wants to use this on Roger once he can be found. Eddie encounters Baby Herman, Roger's co-star, who swears that Roger is innocent and that Acme's will, which would have left Toontown to the Toons, has gone missing. If the will is not found by midnight, Toontown could be sold at public auction. Roger himself turns up at Eddie's office and pleads his innocence. Eddie begins to investigate the case deeper with his on-off girlfriend Dolores and Roger's Toon taxicab friend Benny, while trying to keep Roger hidden from the Toon Patrol. Now, Benny is another one that I absolutely loved. This is one just little small saying I got from Benny.
Out of my way, handsome man!
The whole scene... that whole scene when they're when Roger's in the office and Eddie's trying to kick him out, and of course, you know, cartoons. I mean, in this film, we are led to believe that you can't do anything to a toon that they can't get out of. You know, you can drop a safe on their head, you can drop a refrigerator on their head, you can drop whatever you want to on them, and they just kind of plop up and go back to normal. You know, and then he's. One thing I don't get, now maybe you can explain this, if that's true, why in the world, when he's got Roger in the dishwater, Roger can't breathe? If you can drop a safe on the guy's head, why wouldn't that, I don't know, I mean, I know that's a minor gripe, but that makes no sense.
The logic is just one of those things is you just kind of have to throw a little bit out the window in regards to that, because it basically is just reacting how we would react, right. Obviously, if it so, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just kind of one of those things you just kind of have to put away your, basically put on your disbelief for a bit, and just let it happen.
Yes. Alright, let's see. So Valiant is visited by Jessica, who reveals that she was forced by Maroon to get close to Acme or else he would have ruined Roger's career. Now, we really didn't talk about the Jessica scene in the club. I mentioned it. I know that Kathleen Turner voiced Jessica. I don't remember for the life of me who was the singing part, because I know it wasn't... I know Kathleen Turner did not do the singing. I know they had two separate voice actresses for it.
I'm trying to remember who it is right now. I think it was someone that Amy. I think it was Amy Irving, I believe was the name.
Let's see. Yeah, Amy Irving supplied the singing voice. Wow, she had three voices. Okay. We'll cover that in the when we get down to the cast stuff. But, right. That scene can leave any guy cold, the club mm-hmm. scene. And that's all we're going to say about it, folks. And this is her explanation for the way that she is.
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
So we have Jessica at the office, and of course Dolores walks in with Eddie's pants down, and you know, I don't know. Valiant then questions Maroon, who tells him that Cloverleaf Industries wouldn't buy his studio unless Acme sold Toontown to them, but Acme refused to do so, and he was going to set up Acme with the pictures of him and Jessica. But before he can explain any further, Maroon is shot by a mysterious assassin. Eddie sees Jessica, and again, this is a very, very jumping around synopsis thing here, because that's just the way that that wiki is.
right.
Eddie sees Jessica fleeing from the studio and overcoming his anxiety, pursues her into Toontown, but the culprit turns out to be Judge Doom. And I got to play one more clip really quick. Right before he has hesitation about going into Toontown because obviously that's where his brother Teddy was killed. And another scene that I absolutely died laughing from was this.
It wouldn't seem here.
Teddy Valiant, well, you're a sight for sore eyes.
I ain't seen you deny on to 5 years.
Where you been?
Drunk. You feeling frisky tonight, fellas?
Yeah!
Let's go.
The cartoon bullets, you gotta love them.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that you may recognize definitely the voice, one of them, his name is done by the voice of Jim Cummings, who voiced a lot of Disney characters from like the Disney afternoons, like stuff from Darkwing Duck to Tailspin to even DuckTales. So that's another Disney crossover.
Yes, as I said before, I think this was Warner Brothers / Warner Brothers and Disney doing a very large team up where you're never going to see this ever again except in this film. As they attempt to bring Doom to the authorities, Eddie, Jessica, and Roger are all captured by the Toon Patrol, and they are taken to the Acme warehouse. Doom reveals his plans. As the sole stockholder in Cloverleaf Industries, he bought the red car, and he plans to buy Toontown, the Acme Company, and Maroon Cartoon Studios, and then erase them to make way for a freeway for Los Angeles to wipe out Toontown. Doom has built a vehicle with a large dip vat, and he plans to spray throughout the district, wiping out all the Toons. As Roger and Jessica struggle to avoid being hit by the spray of the dip, Eddie manages to get free and causes the weasels of the Toon Patrol to die of laughter. Various comedic antics, leaving the dip sprayer running automatically. And the song and dance that Eddie does will be the outro to the show. I always thought that scene, he's really struggling to act in that scene, Eddie is. Hey, Ben.
I don't know if he was struggling to act. It's just, it's definitely obviously singing and dancing is not his strong suit. So I think that he did. I mean, in a way, it worked because of the character, the way he is. He's obviously the character Eddie Valiant is not a fan of tunes, so he doesn't really get it as of yet. But I mean, he's slowly starting to understand that that this is basically a tune and human world. So he kind of has to be a part of it, and basically, in order to be able to kind of defeat Doom and his henchmen, you have to do what they do, and that's sing and dance.
Eddie and Doom then fight using assorted Toon props found within the factory until Eddie is able to run Doom over with a road roller, which actually it was a steamroller. The crush does not kill Doom, however. Instead, Doom reveals himself to be a Toon, the same one that killed Eddie's brother. Eddie manages to open the drain on the dip sprayer, showering Doom with the mixture and dissolving him. Eddie frees Roger and Jessica, their relationship having been mended, while the dip sprayer harmlessly crashes through the warehouse wall into Toontown and immediately smashed by a Toon train. As numerous Toons enter the warehouse to see what the commotion is, Eddie discovers Acme's will written in disappearing, reappearing ink on an apparent blank piece of paper that Acme had given to Jessica, that Roger later wrote a love poem to his wife on. With the will in hand, the Toons celebrate their ownership of Toontown and sing Smile, Darn You, Smile, while Roger and Jessica, as well as Eddie and Dolores, rekindle their relationships. Now, I have one other clip that I'm going to play, and I didn't bring this up earlier, but this is the second of the very first ever on-air or on-screen performances. This is Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse.
Hey, what's up, Doc? Jumping without a parachute? Kinda dangerous, ain't it?
Yeah. You can get killed, huh?
You guys got a spare?
Bugs does.
Yeah,
but I don't think you want it.
I do. Give it to me.
Gee, better let him have it, Bugs.
Okay, Doc. Whatever you say, here's the spare.
Thank you.
That scene was actually longer, but when I went to record the clip, I didn't at all. After Eddie goes down, the camera pans back up to Bugs and Mickey, and he goes, "Oh, gee," you know, and Mickey says something, and Bugs goes, "Oh, gee, ain't I a stinker?" This film has got to be one of the best films that, I mean. You know, you can say what you want. You know, people that may not like Bob Hoskins, you can say what you want about his acting ability, whatever, but for the role that he was given, I thought it was very well done.
Well, he added the kind of, very 1940s private detective sort of feel to it. He was just very, obviously, he played an alcoholic kind of really well. I mean, it was sort of a character that you... that you like, but then you don't like at the same time. It's not like love to hate or hate to love, but it's kind of, he kind of rides that fine line. It's like he's kind of despicable at times, but then he definitely has some good qualities to him. So, you know, I personally like Bob Hoskins as Eddie Valiant. I didn't have.
Oh no, I don't. But I mean, I don't know. For some odd reason, there may be some people that do have problems with him. Actually, it's funny, producer Steven Spielberg's first choice for Eddie Valiant was Harrison Ford, but he was asking for too much money. He just came off of the first Star Wars trilogy. Indiana Jones.
I think he was doing, I think he was definitely doing Indiana Jones by that point. So, yeah, I mean, yes. Of course he would ask.
Now, I don't know if this is true or not. I didn't really look this up, but every time I see the name Charles Fleischer, I always think of the... it's Max Fleischer that did the Superman cartoons, wasn't it? Oops, never mind.
Yep.
I don't know. I always had that confused. Never mind. So Charles Fleischer provides the voice of Roger Rabbit, an A-list toon working for Maroon Cartoons. Roger is eventually framed for murder for the death of Marvin Acme. To facilitate Hoskins' performance, Fleischer dressed in a Roger Bunny suit and stood in behind camera for most scenes. Animation director Richard Williams explained Roger Rabbit was a combination of Tex Avery's cashew nut-shaped head and the swatch of red hair like Droopy's, Oswald the Lucky Rabbit's overalls, Porky Pig's bow, and Mickey Mouse's gloves. That's interesting. So at least we know where the design came from. One scene I did forget to mention was the when Eddie's in Toontown and he goes in the elevator. That's another scene that always makes me crack up. Going up, sir. Droopy. Going up, dog. Sir. Going down. And Eddie's like on the floor. Yeah. Hey, do that again.
You're floor here.
Okay, we have Droopy with us, ladies and gentlemen. Yes. Christopher Lloyd played Judge Doom, the sadistic judge of Toontown District Superior Court and main antagonist of the film. He previously worked with director Zemeckis in Amblin Entertainment and Back to the... That's right, I remember when we were doing the Back to the Future episode, the first episode of M-Wire, we had mentioned that once Back to the Future 2 and 3, Zemeckis was going between three films in those years. He was going between those two and this.
Yep.
Wow. I completely blanked on that one. Kathleen Turner provides the voice of Jessica Rabbit, Roger Rabbit's physically attractive wife. Amy Irving supplied the singing voice, while Betsy Brantley served as the stand-in. Where's my man? Yeah, that was freakish. Joanna Cassidy as Dolores, Eddie's on-and-off girlfriend who helps him and Roger solve the case. It's actually funny. The only other thing that I remember her from, like, she'll pop up and I'll remember her, but the main thing I always remember her from is Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember much obviously of Kathy Turner. I mean, other than just a lot of movies that she did in the past, but Amy Irving, I actually do remember because mm-hmm. I'm a fan of Alias, and Amy Irving plays the wife of Sloane, main kind of bad guy from seasons 1 and 2, and so. It didn't clue into that until all of a sudden, like, I remember watching Roger Rabbit recently and then watching Alias around the same time, and I was like, wow, those voices are kind of similar. I guess the singing voice. And then I realized it was the same person. I'm like, now that's cool.
You have Alan Tilvern as R.K. Maroon, short-tempered owner of Maroon Cartoon Studios. Let's see. This was Tilvern's final theatrical performance before his death. Hmm. Stubby K as Marvin Acme. I'm trying. See, I could have sworn that some of these casting lists would just give more about the actor than what they actually played in the film, but apparently not. Lou Hirsch provides the voice of Baby Herman. Roger's frequent co-star in Maroon cartoons, Williams said that Baby Herman was a mixture of Elmer Fudd and Tweety crushed together. April Winchell provides the voice of Mrs. Herman and the baby noises. Wow. Elmer Fudd and Tweety Bird crashed together. That's a strange combination.
Yeah, especially with the kind of the gruff voice that it came out with.
Yeah, that's a really strange... wow. Richard Parmenter has a small role as Lieutenant Santino. Joel Silver makes his cameo appearance as the frustrated director at the beginning of the film. Archive sound of Frank Sinatra from Witchcraft was used for the singing sword, in addition to Charles Fleischer. The Weasel Gang voices were provided by David L. Lander, Fred Newman, and June Foray. Mel Blanc voiced Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Tweety Bird, Porky Pig, and Sylvester. This would be the final film in which Blank would voice these characters, so we were right earlier. Joe Oleski actually voiced Yosemite Sam and Foghorn Leghorn. Other voice work was provided by Wayne Allwine, which I think he passed away too, as Mickey Mouse. Recently, I think he did. That's what I'm saying. Last, like maybe earlier this year or late last year, I could have sworn I saw. Yeah.
Oh, no, actually it was this year, May 18th.
No. Tony Pope as the Big Bad Wolf, and Goofy Rusty Taylor as the Birds, Minnie Mouse, and Tony Ancelo as Donald Duck. Ancelo.
Apparently, actually, Tony Ancelo, I looked it up, he apparently is the more... He's the guy who's recently playing Donald Duck.
I wonder who the original was.
I can look that up. I love the internet for that very reason.
Overall, you know, this is one of those feel-good movies. This is a...
Oh, totally. It's one that kind of, obviously, it was kind of one of the really first ones that appealed to kids, but grown-ups at the same time.
Yes, and that is one of the reasons why that this was put under the Disney Touchstone name and not Walt Disney Pictures itself, because it wasn't... Back then, Disney, I don't actually know how many live-action Disney films were going on. I'm sure there were a lot. I'm sure there were some... between, obviously, the golden age of animation and when this was released, but back in the 80s, I mainly knew Disney for their animation films, like, you know, Lady and the Tramp, Cinderella, all that kind of stuff. And they actually created Touchstone Pictures to be for adults, so they could show, like, a PG-13 movie or, you know, something like that. That way, because I believe, I can't be certain, but I either read somewhere or heard a rumor that Disney at the time wanted all of their animation to be G-rated, which is what majority of it is. So who is the original? Do you know?
The original was Clarence Nash, and he died in 85, so that's why at the time it was it was Tony.
Mr. Anselmo takes... he does an excellent... I couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah, with Donald Duck, it's kind of hard, really.
Yeah.
I mean, if you could do it well, it's kind of hard to really tell who really sort of did that voice. Obviously, you need someone that can be able to do the work well and do the voice well to kind of really make it seem like there's no transition between between the two people doing the voices. I mean, let's say for instance, Bugs Bunny, the person who's voicing it now.
Right.
Obviously, is not Mel Blanc. Does not do the. I mean, he does a decent job, but isn't exactly Kermit the Frog. Exact same way. His son, Jim Henson's son, Robert, or I think it's Robert or Brian. Can never remember which. He's doing the voice of Kermit the Frog now, and obviously that's very much different. So, but with Donald Duck, it's kind of one of those voices that's so indescript that it's kind of hard to really tell who's playing who. But the fact that both of them did extremely well, obviously Tony did a really good job as far as being able to kind of take that and make it seem like it was the original. And I think it was probably the closest anybody ever came to reproducing that voice. But
As far as Mel Blanc and doing Bugs, as far as the differences with Bugs nowadays. I think a majority of people try to emulate Blank, but I don't think that they would go as far as Blank did when he first started crafting the voice for Bugs. He would actually eat carrots when he would do the, what's up, Doc? He would actually eat the carrots as, they would show him an animation cell or they would show him a drawing of Bugs eating carrots, and he would actually eat carrots and do the voice, and I thought that was a really cool thing. As I mentioned before, there were a little bit of problems. The reason why this was released under Touchstone, Michael Eisner, the then president of the Walt Disney Company, complained Who Framed Roger Rabbit was too risque with sexual innuendos. Eisner and Zemeckis disagreed over elements with the film, but since Zemeckis had final cut privilege, he refused to make alterations. Jeffrey Katzenberg felt it was appropriate to release the film under their Touchstone Pictures banner. Who Framed Roger Rabbit opened on June 22nd, 1988, in America, grossing $11 million. I'm just going to round it up or down. $11 million in 1,045 theaters during its opening weekend. The film went on to gross a total of $156 million in North America and $173 million internationally, coming to a worldwide total of $329.8 million. Wow. That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money.
At the time of release, Roger Rabbit was the 20th highest grossing film of all time. The film was also the second highest grossing film of 1988, only behind Rain Man. Wow. That's something I would not put those two films together.
No. No, you wouldn't think so. I mean, those are two big stars in that one, Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman, and you would think that, yeah. I mean, who knew that the little animation movie, the live-action animation movie kind of would become second in that list.
It won several Academy Awards for sound editing, visual effects, and film editing. Nominations included art direction, cinematography, and sound. As far as the legacy for it, the success of Who Framed Roger Rabbit rekindled the interest in Golden Age American animation and sparked modern animation scene. In 1991, Walt Disney Imagineering began to develop Mickey's Toontown for Disneyland based on the Toontown that appeared in the film. The attraction also features a ride called Roger Rabbit's Cartoon Spin. Three theatrical short cartoons were also produced. Tummy Trouble played in front of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Roller Coaster Rabbit was shown with Dick Tracy, and Trail Mix Up was included with Far Off Place. The film also inspired short-lived comic book and video game spin-offs, including a PC game, the Japanese version of the Bugs Bunny Crazy Castle, which features Roger instead of Bugs, and in a 1989 game release on the Nintendo Entertainment System. Those cartoons I just mentioned, all of those are on the two-disc Buena Vista series special edition DVD. I've never had this on DVD. I have it now, obviously. But at the time, I had never had it, and I just saw it in Best Buy one day, and I saw just the case that it came in. It has Benny. It has Benny on the front with Roger, Eddie, and Jessica in the cab. You slip the slip cover off. It shows as like a old-time 40s notebook because it is a two-disc edition. It opens up in three different parts, and on the left-hand side, you know how they have DVD booklets that will show you the special features and chapters and all that stuff? Well, this opens up like a notepad, and it reads like a detective's notepad or like a policeman's notepad. Yes, DVDs themselves, I gotta say, this is very ingenious. They actually, they look like film reels on the actual discs for the art. Oh, nice. And then the first disc is the, they have family-friendly bonus features, and then the second disc has the enthusiast bonus features, which include a bunch of stuff. They include the trailer. They include, you know, a Toontown game where you can interact. It's just an awesome, awesome two-disc DVD to have, and I'm very glad that I have it. So, yes. Do you... You don't own this on DVD, do you? Or do you? I don't know if you...
No, unfortunately, I do not. Yes. I wish I could own them.
As far as the controversies for the film, with the film's Laserdisc release, Variety first reported in March 1994 that observers uncovered several scenes of subliminal antics from the animators that featured a brief nudity of the Jessica Rabbit character. While undetectable when played at the usual rate of 24 film frames per second, the Laserdisc player allowed the viewer to advance frame by frame to uncover these visuals. Many retailers said that within minutes of the Laserdisc debut, their entire inventory was sold out. Well, duh! Yeah. The run was fueled by media reports about the controversy, including stories in CNN and various newspapers. A Disney exec responded to Variety that people need to get a life than to notice stuff like that. We were never aware of it. It is just stupid gimmick. The animators pulled on us and we didn't notice it. Oh, yeah, that's just like you people didn't notice that part of the castle in The Little Mermaid is a dick joke, basically. Sure, okay. At the same time, people also need to develop a sense of humor with these things. One scene involves Herman extending his middle finger as he passes under a woman's dress, reemerging with drool on his lip. Oh my god. But other rumors also exist. Gary Wolf, the author of the novel Who Censored Roger Rabbit, filed a lawsuit in 2001 against the Walt Disney Company. Wolf claimed he was owed royalties based on the value of gross receipts and merchandising sales. In 2002, the trial court in the case ruled that these only referred to actual cash receipts Disney collected and denied Wolf's claim. In its January 2004 ruling, the California Court of Appeal disagreed, finding that expert testimony introduced by Wolf regarding the customary use of gross receipts in the entertainment business could support a broader reading of the term. Ruling vacated the trial courts in favor of Disney and remanded the case for further proceedings. In March 2005 hearing, Wolf estimated he was owed $7 million. Disney's attorneys not only disputed the claim, but said Wolf actually owed Disney $500,000 to $1 million because of an accounting error discovered in preparing for the lawsuit. Oh, good Lord. It's Hollywood, people. Thank God I don't live in California. Oh, my God. I would not want to live in that state. Holy crap.
Well, that's the thing with, I guess, it's kind of tough when you're an author and you have a book or a story that's kind of put out there as a film, is that you don't really have a lot of I guess, say in the film. Like, you would think that J.K. Rowling would have a lot of say in Harry Potter, and she did because to a degree. But it was still up to the producers and the director of how they want the film to happen. You kind of have to, unless you want to be, the author wants to be, is able to be involved from the very beginning of production to right to the end, then a movie can be made the way the author wanted it to. But just due to time or production costs or whichever, a lot of that doesn't happen. So that's where we get a lot of these lawsuits from, is because the fact that Wolf kind of they got the producers got the rights to it, they made the movie, and really kind of let the
There has been rumors lately over the last several months of the prequel, and I have some prequel information here. They were actually going to make a sequel, or I don't think the words remake were ever entered, but like a sequel or a prequel was. With the critical and financial success of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Walt Disney Pictures and Steven Spielberg felt it was obvious to plan a second installment. Matt Maldwin wrote a prequel titled Roger Rabbit the Toon Platoon, set in 1941. Similar to the previous film, Toon Platoon featured many cameo appearances with characters from the golden age of American animation. It began with Roger Rabbit's early years living on a farm in the Midwestern United States, with human Richie Davenport. Roger travels west to seek his mother, in a process meeting Jessica Krupnik, his future wife, a struggling Hollywood actress. Jessica is kidnapped and forced to make pro-Nazi Germany broadcasts, thus Roger and Richie must save her by going into Nazi-occupied Europe after their triumph. Roger and Richie are given a Hollywood Boulevard parade, and Roger is finally reunited with his mother and father. Bugs Bunny, the film would have gone direct to video. Okay, I don't see Bugs Bunny as Roger Rabbit's father. I'm sorry. If you wanted to try to take, if you wanted to go the Tiny Toons route and try to make Buster Bunny Bugs Bunny's son, I could see that. Because the Tiny Toons are basically offshoots of the Looney Tunes character. But Roger Rabbit, no.
No, I like I said, I'd see more Roger Rabbit as one that came before Bugs Bunny did. So it wouldn't. I don't think it would have worked out.
Maudlin later retitled the script Who Discovered Roger Rabbit. Spielberg left the project when deciding he could not satirize Nazis after directing Schindler's List. Michael Eisner commissioned a rewrite in 1997 with Sherry Stoner, Slappy Squirrel, and Deanna Oliver. Although they kept Roger's search for his mother, Stoner and Oliver changed the story to Roger's inadvertent rise to stardom on Broadway and Hollywood. Disney was impressed, and Alan Menken was hired to write 5 songs for the film and offered his services as executive producer. One of the songs, This Only Happens in the Movies, was recorded in 2008, on the debut album of Broadway actress Carrie Butler. Eric Goldberg was set to be the new animation director and began to redesign Roger's new character appearance. One of the problems, and this applies to anything that I have with prequels, I'm so used to it could be animation, it could be what live action, whatever. You know, you take Dumb and Dumber, okay? I'm so used to seeing Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels as those characters when they did Dumb and Dumberer and used 2 other actors as their younger son. I don't know about... Now, I mean, I know animation's slightly different where you can kind of retool them to look like they're like their original creation, but a little bit younger, but I don't know. That's just one issue I have with prequels.
Well, the thing is about prequels is that I'm not a fan of them in general. I don't know, maybe it's just Star Wars kind of left a big bad taste in my mouth in regards to prequels. But the thing is, I just don't like about it because they try so much to recapture the magic of the original by trying to tie in so many different things to the original, that a lot of the story is lost in the prequel because they're so trying to tie up all the stories that lead into the original story of the original movie or the original product, whatever it's coming from. I think personally, prequels suck. I don't think I've ever seen really any prequel that was good. And I don't know if maybe there's something. Maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's just.
It all depends on, like, if they were going to do just a cartoon and not a live-action cartoon mixture, if they were just going to do a cartoon showing Roger's rise to stardom, that would be fine because, as I said, you can do pretty much anything in animation and still keep the general character. But if they're going to do a live-action and animation, first of all, Bob Hoskins... There's nobody, I don't think you could find anybody that looks like him, even a younger version of him, to put this prequel, you know, 4 or 5 years ahead, like 4 or 5 years ahead of before 1947.
Right.
I don't know.
That is a tough one. I mean, you definitely, it's tough to obviously replace anybody. And I don't know. I mean, see, I can see a sequel, definitely, because then you can possibly have the same people involved. You can have other new characters if you wanted to. But, I mean, I heard recently that there was news that the original writers of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, like the screenwriters, were possibly making a sequel instead of a prequel.
According to information I have, in March of 2003, producer Don Hahn said, "Don't expect a Roger Rabbit sequel anytime soon. Animation today is completely conquered by computers, and traditional animation just isn't in the forefront anymore." In December of 2007, Marshall admitted he was still open to the idea, and in April 2009, Zemeckis revealed he was still interested. Now, which Marshall are they talking about? I don't see his name. Oh, Frank Marshall. Okay. If it happens, it happens. I don't want it. My only fear is that they're going to try to remake what they've already made, and they're going to do a horrible job at it. You know, like these... I know we're kind of getting off on a tangent here, but, you know, the remake cycle... remaking Nightmare on Elm Street, remaking Friday the 3rd, all this stuff. Now, granted, those films, that they're not my forte, and I probably won't watch them. Ever since I've seen the first Nightmare on Elm Street when I was like 5 or 6, I have been completely turned off of horror films altogether. But, you know, I don't like remakes.
No, I don't like... I really don't like them either. I think the only remake that's been done well is Star Trek. I'm not saying this because I'm a huge Star Trek fan, but I think remakes, sequels, and prequels, it's a lot of what Hollywood is doing now, only because it's safe, is to do these sort of prequel sequels to already established franchises, and they're not really allowing anyone to really create anything new, so to speak. I mean, I think the most original movie that came out as of this year was definitely District 13.
You mean District 9?
Oh, I'm sorry, District 9. I'm thinking Warehouse 13 combined with that with the show District 13. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's 12 o'clock at
night. Oh, we're almost.
So District Nine. Actually, well, no, actually, you know, that kind of ties in. Warehouse 13 is also another one that was kind of very original titles that TV's starting to get it. Like TV's getting that a lot of people are clamoring for original new content. That's why Heroes became so big when it came out. That's why Fringe became so big when it came out. It's people are clamoring for this new stuff that instead of just remakes. I mean, the only reason why remakes and sequels and prequels or whatever do well at the box office, generally for the most part, is because they already had established fans. That's all they're going for. That's all the Hollywood is going for with those people, is just so they can get automatic buzz. butts in seats in a movie theater opening weekend, because that's all it is now. It's the opening weekend. It has nothing to do with DVD sales or overall ticket sales, whatever. It has everything to do with getting that first weekend top of the box office. If they can get that, they don't care really about how much money it really makes, even if it is it doesn't make as much as their budget was. And you gotta think, I mean, at the time, Who Framed Roger Rabbit was made for $40 million, which isn't a lot now compared to our standards, but at that time, that was a huge deal for a movie of that kind of size, was a $40 million budget. And they definitely made that back. But that's the thing, because at the time, a lot of people loved watching original stuff. That's why a lot of films from the 80s and early 90s, you got a lot of originality. But now, everyone's just playing it safe. Everyone is just going by the numbers, and let's just make a paint-by-numbers movie that people of this franchise, or fans of this franchise, are going to enjoy, and that's about it. And I don't... when you get those rare gems like District 9 or even on TV Warehouse 13 or Fringe or whatever, you get those, a lot of people sort of clamor to it, and a lot of the big established in Hollywood are kind of afraid of that, even though the numbers may not be as high as what they would expect it to be a breakout hit. They don't really give them a big chance. Hollywood does not give them does not take a big risk on it, and that's why I kind of praise Peter Jackson for taking that risk on Neil Blomkamp for District 9. So I know my District 9. I know it. Just saying. That's why he gave him a chance, because he saw what Neil Blomkamp could do. And he thinks it was an awesome idea, and he ran with it. And some people are slowly starting to some producers are slowly starting to do that. Like Guillermo del Toro is kind of known for doing a lot of that. Even just kind of taking on with his own projects. So there's just a lot of people are slowly moving towards that sort of original content idea. But I think we're still going to see a lot of remakes, a lot of stuff from original franchises that have already been established. We're going to see that for a little while. And eventually that well is going to run dry, and that's just going to make it easy for new filmmakers to kind of bring up their own, to create their own franchises, create their own big hits. And then I'd say within about 5 to 10 years, we'll start to see a lot more
originality. Yeah, I got to say, this year, 2009, I did not see a whole heck of a lot of remakes. I think that if you go back... I don't know, maybe I'm not really paying attention, but let me just finish this. I think that from 2004 to 2008, those 4 years, those were the years for remakes. You had the Bionic Woman remake, you had the Knight Rider remake, just on TV. I don't know, maybe I'm not watching a whole hell of a lot of TV these days, I don't know, but...
Well, I'm talking, general, I should probably say I'm just sort of generalizing remakes films. In regards to also people taking films, TV, but more in regards to just taking old franchises, like franchises that may not have made it into movies, or they had made movies in the 80s, it just didn't do that well, and kind of making it new. So you got like this year, obviously there was the Transformers, you had Star Trek, you have Sherlock Holmes coming up, even though Marvel in itself is kind of they make remakes, but they make them really well, and that's the thing, because the creators of the original properties are making the film. So in a way, all these sort of franchises that were made back in the 80s or whatever are starting to kind of, people are just taking those and saying, okay, let's take Transformers and we'll make that into a movie, because there's people that like Transformers, there's fans of it, and so there's that. I kind of lump that in.
Yeah, but you really, I mean, this is a discussion for another show, but I mean, you really can't lump Transformers, you can't say Transformers and Transformers 2 is, they're not remakes, they're live action versions of an animated and comic property. I wouldn't really say that those are remakes, because that's never been done before. Now, if you want to take and say that the Star Trek film is a remake, that could be argued, because technically it's its own universe. It set up its own universe, really. But, you know, it's a topic for a whole other show. But, you know, overall, getting back to Roger Rabbit before we have to close out, I think everybody should actually go out and get this two-disc edition DVD for your collection, especially if you're a Roger Rabbit fan. It actually, I forgot to mention earlier, it comes with, now, I don't know, it's probably just stamped on, but it comes with two glossies, one of Roger and one of Jessica, and they are both signed. And I have them framed in the other room. I don't have them hung up in my new apartment yet. But I actually, when I was at my old apartment, I had them framed in frames because I didn't want anything to happen to them, obviously. So this DVD is a very much must pick up. We will be right back with the outro information.
There once was a boy, an albino, I'm told, who possessed the power of Pen Pusher Gold. He had many stories, all short and exciting, but nobody knew, and so he began writing. He sat there all summer and skillfully sought to perfectly ponder and polish each plot. The settings were set, all the characters cast, his fingers were flying and flailing so fast, and soon the young man with the snowy complexion quickly concocted the caffeine collection. He smiled, satisfied with his clever creation. Oh, the things that did pour from his imagination. Stories of pirates and future police, of devils and bullies, and a twist press release. Fantasy, mystery, both are included. Comedy, action, no genre excluded. You say to yourself, it's too good to be true, but author Steve Saylor would not lie to you. An audiobook so you don't have to read. And hey, $15 is all that you need.
From the author of the podcast novel Black Shadow, Steve Saylor presents The Caffeine Collection, a dynamic audiobook collection of short stories presented by ringtonefeeder.com and stevesaylor.net. Steve presents a genre mashup of multiple stories for your ears.
I have to be on caffeine to write all this.
Steve Saylor presents The Caffeine Collection, on sale October 28th, 2009.
So mark this date down so you will not forget. For more information, stevesaylor.net.
We are back, and this is the outro. So, Mr. World Famous Author, do you have anything you want to plug? This is
the
section.
Yes, you can actually go to my website, stevesaylor.net, and you can actually pick up the Caffeine Collection, a short story collection written by myself. And you can actually be able to get that in many different formats. You can get an audio format, which you can find also at ringtonefeeder.com. You can also be able to get a print version and a PDF version of the book as well. But pretty much the best way to be able to get all that info is, like I said, at stevesaylor.net.
Yes, and so everybody is not confused, that is spelled S-A-Y-L-O-R.
You can definitely go there, but also S-A-I-L-O-R .net, that URL is also registered to me as well.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Well, I don't know. I was
a smart one.
Wow, you actually sounded like Skids or Mudflap there for a minute. Holy crap.
I was a smart one, dude.
Do you have anything else other than Caffeine Collection that you would like to plug? I know that you're on a hiatus from This Week in Geek, but is there anything else you want to plug out?
No, yeah, we could plug out, obviously, This Week in Geek. I am still sort of still a part of that that show, obviously. I am on hiatus, as you mentioned, but if you want to check that out, you can go to thisweekingeek.net.
One of the founding members has been kicked out.
No, there's no way I'm being kicked out, man.
Alright, so going into the official closing for our show, thank you for joining us here on Tooncast and Movie Week in Review. There are several ways to get in contact with us or leave feedback for the shows. First, you can visit www.geekcastradio.com and find all the other GCR and podcasts there. The second is you can stop by predaconempire.com/nexus. Those are our new forums, and get all your GCR and Transformers discussion topics there. The third is you can leave the show feedback on iTunes. Now, we don't have any new reviews on iTunes for Tooncast. I checked it before. I checked it actually the other night. And I know that we don't have any reviews for M-Wire, so I know we have subscribers for this for the M-Wire show. So yeah, people, go leave reviews. That's the best way to help us on iTunes. The fourth is you can visit www.earth-2.net, which is another great geek culture website. We have threads in their self-promotion section of their forums. And the fifth is the email address, which is gcrnmwire@gmail.com for the MWire podcast and gcrntooncast@gmail.com for the Tooncast show. You can also follow us on Twitter. The show names there are GCRN Tooncast and GCRN MWire. Mine is TFG and Mike, and what is your Twitter, sir?
Steve Saylor.
Yes. And that is with the Y, not the I.
But I do have with the I as well registered, and it just says it just has one tweet that says "Go here. This is where you. This is where I am." This is not the Steve Saylor you're looking for. Is actually what it says.
Wow, that's funny.
Interesting thing about that that particular account is that I actually have followers there for some odd reason. I have 10 followers. I don't know why. This is one tweet. Sorry, this is not Steve Saylor you were looking for. Sorry for the confusion. I'm actually Steve Saylor with a Y. And that's all it says.
Wow, that's funny. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tooncast and MWire. Wish that you join us next time for Tooncast in episode 25. I am actually joined by Steve Megatron, Pecan Court Michael, and Kevin Professor Boss K Dog Thompson. Kevin is the original Tooncast co-host. When I got rid of my iPhone, I thought I lost the numbers, but they're in my computer somewhere. I don't know. I just did a search for them, and I found Kevin's phone number out of the blue, and I'm like, wait, I have a paid subscription to Skype to be able to call people. I can just call his ass every Sunday night or whatever night we're going to record Tooncast, and he can be back on the show. So, yeah, episode 25, Kevin did rejoin us. For MWire, it'll be episode 19, which we will be covering the movie Can't Hardly Wait. For now, I am TFG and Michael with
Steve Snowball Saylor.
Say any more words of Elizabeth Shue, don't fuck with the babysitter, and thank you for listening. Until next time.
Sword of Omens, give me sight beyond sight. I see a new episode of Tooncast coming this week.
One of these days, you idiots are gonna laugh yourselves to death!
I just want you to know something about the guy you're gonna get.
Now Roger is his name. Laughter is his game. Come on, you dope, untie his rope and watch him go insane.
He's lost his mind.
I don't think so.
This singing ain't my line. It's tough to make a rhyme. If I get stuck, I'm out of luck.
I'm running out of time.
Thanks. Taking falls. I'm bouncing off the walls. Without that gun and have some fun, I'd kick you in the...
Nose? That don't rhyme with walls.
No, but this does.